Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Scott Hodes, and I represent appellants in this FOIA matter. The issue today is whether the government met its burden in establishing its withholdings under FOIA exemptions 1, 3, and 5, and whether it conducted an adequate search for responsive records. The FOIA request at issue began being made by my clients between the years 2004 to 2007. In late 2007, when very few responsive records had been, responsive FOIA requests had been processed, my clients were forced to file a litigation. After the litigation began, some records were released by the government. However, there were many withheld holdings made, and following a dispositive motion, the district court found for the government, even though it failed to provide specificity in its Vaughan indexes, and my clients were forced to file this appeal. The first issue I'd like to address is that of whether Exemption 3 applies to the withheld records. And there are three Exemption 3 statutes which the government has used to withhold information. The first is subsection 2605H of the Convention on Cultural Property Implementation Act. 2605H incorporates the Federal Advisory Committee Act into the Cultural Property Advisory Committee of the State Department with some exceptions. And those exceptions are what the government holds cites as an Exemption 3 statute. The exception is whenever and to the extent it is determined by the president or his designee that the disclosure of matters involved in the committee's proceedings would compromise the government's negotiating objectives or bargaining positions on the negotiation of any agreement authorized by this chapter, the government then, in a subsequent FOIA request, believes that they may withhold this material under FOIA Exemption 3. The appellants do not believe so. The appellants believe that this is a temporal limit and that under a subsequent FOIA request, after the negotiations cited in the subsection are concluded, the government needs to go back and look under the FOIA and see if any of the other eight exemptions, if they want to withhold the material, see if any of the other eight exemptions might apply. And so we believe that it's not an Exemption 3 statute.
That isn't the way it reads.
Excuse me?
I mean, that isn't the way it reads. It says the secretary, the assistant secretary, it's an assistant secretary, right?
It's
can issue this thing, whenever. It says whenever it is determined. It's not limited in time.
Well,
it says whenever.
It says that, but it also, Your Honor, says that it's pursuant to the bargaining positions on negotiations of an agreement authorized by this chapter. So
it's what?
It's the wording of the statute states that it's pursuant to the workings of the advisory committee for the bargaining positions of the agreement authorized by the CPIA. Alternatively, Your Honor, even if it is an Exemption 3 statute, We don't believe that the government met its burden in establishing that it met the requirements of the statute. So...
You're not arguing, are you, that the Assistant Secretary didn't make this declaration, right?
We're arguing that we have no idea, that they never made any... There's nothing in the record to indicate that the Assistant Secretary ever did this.
What about the declaration? What about the Vaughan Declaration?
Well, the Vaughan Index... doesn't cite any specifics.
No, but it says it. It says what it did.
It, well,
it says the undersecretary issued the 306H determination.
It says that they often entered them for these CPAC proceedings, but it doesn't. The CPAC, the Cultural Property Advisory Committee, meets frequently, and for the requests, there were a number of requests, and there were different Cultural Property Advisory Committee meetings at issue, and they never cite to where the meetings were closed, and also those meetings that of the Cultural Property Advisory Committee Act. The entire meetings are not closed. So parts of the record should be indicated where, what the government did not do is cite where in those meetings it was open and which it was closed. It's just a very conclusory statement in saying that they closed the meetings. And so we don't believe that because there are specific instances of the records. There's no dates given or anything like that provided of when the meetings were closed, that we don't believe that the government met its burden under subsection 2605H. The second Exemption 3 statute that the government cites is subsection 2605I1 of the CPIA, and appellants would agree with the government that this could be used as an Exemption 3 statute. This subsection allows the government to withhold information provided in confidence by the private sector to either the Cultural Property Advisory Committee or the government for use for the CPAC. However, we don't believe that the government met its burden in establishing here that the material was actually provided in confidence.
Which of the actual items that are covered exclusively by 2604I1? I used the plural. I'm not sure if it is plural. There are a number that where there seems to be clear reliance on other exemptions, right?
Yes.
Right. So what is it that's in exclusive reliance on I-1?
I-1 is information that was provided. First, let me back up, Your Honor, that the government's Vaughan indices weren't 100% clear on what they were relying on specifically on this. However, they, I do believe, are trying to withhold information under this exemption, under 2605I1, where it's...
Yes, they assert it in a number of places.
Yes.
But in, I believe, tentatively, in all but one of those places, they assert another ground, so that if you don't challenge the alternative ground, then we would normally just assume you were right on your I-1 challenge, but it wouldn't make any difference.
Yes, Your Honor, and I'm not 100% sure of where they all match up. However,
would you think I would be wrong if I thought that the one place they need I-1 for are the park emails?
Excuse me, the park emails.
Yeah.
I believe that may be correct.
I'm not sure.
I'm not 100% sure, but the park emails are an area of where they asserted. I know they did assert 2605I-1, and we don't believe that they've established why Ms. Park believed that they were
confidential. Yeah, but you understand Judge Williams' question to you.
I do understand.
I mean, if they have another exemption that does apply, who cares? Right, about I-1.
Well, I would agree with you, but I don't think that every instance that they asserted I-1, they also asserted another exemption.
Well, Daniel Park seems to be a case where that's the sole basis. And how do you interpret the email at the top of page 311 of the joint appendix? Getting hi, Andrew.
This is a communication between Ms. Parks and a representative of the State Department working on behalf of CPAC. And while it may have, it could be read a number of ways, you could read this as her not necessarily expecting confidentiality, but not wanting to tell others at this point in time of her involvement with the State Department, because she was more concerned about the State Department's perspective than her own perspective.
Do you think that it precludes the inference that her own desire for confidentiality was controlling, played a material role in her statements here?
If you just read this, you could infer that. However, there's other communications with Ms. Parks, and I believe that there were letters to and from her, there's a number of emails from her,
Is there any from her that seems to completely back off any reliance on her own interest in confidentiality?
Well,
maybe
she,
you're relying on the fact that he was asking for confidentiality. I suppose you could say that one inference is that her interest was entirely in response to his.
I would believe so, because in the email on page 313 to 314, and I think this is the same email. Yeah, it's the same email you're speaking of. She says, I've been encouraged to submit informed public comment and will do so. The informed public comment is a different group of records in which the State Department released that public comment.
She's drawing a distinction there between what she's submitting not for public comment and what she's and the other.
That's a possibility, but we don't know if it's not the same information being provided later on in the public comment portion.
Well, if it's in the public comment, you have it.
We have that, but we don't have what was withheld.
That's right, but what was withheld could not have been in the public comment. That's by definition.
What was withheld in this string here, the email string, because we don't know.
You're saying there could have been things withheld in reality from the public that are not alluded to in the email string.
Yeah, I believe so, Your Honor. The third Exemption 3 statute at issue is 2605 I-2, in which we believe that the court, this allows for the government to withhold material that comes from other government agencies to CPAC, and allows them to protect that information. We believe that the district court actually affirmed or did not affirm the government on this.
Didn't the court grant summary judgment to the government?
They granted summary judgment to the government, yes,
yeah,
but...
You got a big problem with that.
Well, in the footnote, however, in
no,
the
but
ruling,
I'm talking about his order is, yeah, grant summary judgment for the government, and then, did you raise this in your blue brief?
We did not because right. of the footnote.
You mean because you thought you had won? You felt you didn't need to raise it?
We thought we had won, and that like we had, like Judge Williams had brought up previously, that the material they were covered by I-1, we thought they were covering it under both, uh-huh. and that because the court ruled that no rules have been issued here, the exception's not applicable, we didn't feel the need to bring it up because they said the lower court said it was not applicable.
But shouldn't you have gone back to the district judge and cleaned that up? I mean, well, granted summary judgment, there was that's what motions for reconsideration are for.
Quite possibly, we were not until the opposition brief by the.
No, I'm not talking about up here. I'm talking about the district court.
Well, we weren't until we were briefing. We were unaware that the government believed that they had.
Well, after this. Yeah, right. Well, they didn't turn over any documents to you after the summary judgment decision, did they?
No, but what I had just said is we thought that. I-1 and I-2 uh-huh. had overlapped, and so that.
I see. In other words, you thought even though you had won on I-2, the
there would be
I-1
nothing coming to us.
Covered that, I see.
Regardless, yes.
All right.
I'm out of town.
Counsel for Appellee.
May it please the court, Brian Hudak from the U.S. Attorney's Office, on behalf of the appellee, the Department of State. State asked this court to affirm the district court's judgment, which granted the State Department summary judgment on all of plaintiff's FOIA claims. The information withheld by State in this matter is at the heart of its diplomatic activities and its obligations under treaties with foreign governments to protect the looting of foreign states' cultural treasures. At bottom, the guilds asked this court to second-guess state's withholdings, which state has determined would adversely affect its diplomatic objectives. Starting with Exemption 3, just to clear up the I-2 point, the exception that Judge Leon referred to, in I-2, the statute reads that information submitted in confidence by officers or employees of the United States to the committee, that is the Cultural Property Advisory Committee, or CPAC, shall not be disclosed other than in accordance with rules issued by the director of the United States Information Agency after consultation with the committee. So it's an exception to the exemption that it should not be disclosed. And it's pretty clear that that's what Judge Leon was referring to. And in fact, later on, he said that the state's withholdings under I-1 and I-2 were proper.
You want to talk about A-1?
I-1?
Yeah, I-1.
Yes, Your Honor. I-1. The only document that is exclusively redacted
is Park, right?
Yeah, are the Park's emails?
Yeah. Okay, fine.
And in the state's Vaughn Index, it specifically noted that these emails were submitted in confidence to the committee. And if you look on page 311 from Ms. Parks herself, who unfortunately is now deceased, so an additional declaration from her was not possible. But in her own email, it says,
I'm just curious, did you point out those emails in the text of your brief?
No, we did not, Your Honor.
Okay. But
now that the panel raised it, I noticed that in one of her emails it says, please be discreet about our conversation.
I know we raised it. I was asking you whether you had raised it.
No, Your Honor. We refer to the state's Vaughn Declaration.
Right. So let's talk about the Vaughn Declaration, okay?
Yes, Your Honor.
It says, here's all it says. It says, these emails contain some information that was provided in confidence. Right? That's all it says. Now, in your brief, you didn't. You didn't argue with the blue brief's assertion that these confidentiality determinations are governed by our standard FOIA case law, Londano, right?
No, I did not, Your Honor.
And so you accept that. So, can you explain to me how this statement in the Vaughn Index satisfies any of our standards, whether it's a express or implicit? pledge of confidentiality?
Well, the some information, I think, was referring to the fact that these emails were, these documents that had been withheld under I-1 were partially released. Referring to the some information, that is the information that was redacted.
I wasn't arguing about the some. I was asking you whether or not, and how does this meet our Londano standard? Is this governed by Londano? Because this is, there's no express, you're not saying there was an express statement of confidentiality, are you?
I believe there was, Your Honor. I believe
there
that's
was?
What the Fondin index declares. Mm-hmm. It says these emails contain some information, that is the redacted information, uh-huh. that was provided in confidence by Danielle Parks, an individual in the private sector to staff member of ECA's.
Are you familiar with our decision in Campbell?
Your Honor, I do not know which Campbell case you're referring to. Did it?
Campbell versus Department of Justice.
Yes, Your Honor.
The agency must present probative evidence that the source received an express grant of confidentiality. It can take a wide variety of statements, such as notations on the face of the document, the personal knowledge of the affiant, a statement by the source. We don't have any of that in this.
We have a
statement. All you have is a statement by the FOIA officer, right?
Yes, Your Honor, but we have a statement in her own emails, as we pointed out.
You just told me you didn't rely on those in your brief.
Yes, Your Honor, and I don't believe.
What do you mean, yes?
Yes, we did not mention those emails specifically in our brief, Your Honor.
So, so all it says is these statements include some information that was provided in confidence. I don't know any decision of this court that's accepted a statement like that as a sufficient basis for accepting an exemption based on confidentiality. Do you?
I'm unaware of any. Right. A new decision of this court.
Right. Yeah.
Moving on to 2605H, Your Honor, we believe that it is clear from the.
Before we get to that,
yes.
your argument in the end must be that the exchange of emails fills the gap.
Yes, Your Honor.
Filled.
We believe the Vaughan Index was making specific reference to the emails, which are also included in the record, Your Honor.
Okay, and do we have anything the question of deference and fact finding? Is it a matter de novo for the court whether what we see from the provider of information establishes a demand for confidentiality, or is there some sort of deference to someone? And I guess who would the deference be to? There might be deference whether it was Mr. Cohen or the FOIA officer.
Yes, sir. I believe that the agency's bond declaration is established, is afforded deference as far as it being made in good faith, and unless there's something contrary in the record to indicate that it's inaccurate or that this information was not.
I don't know if our cases are that
lenient.
Right.
But Your Honor, I mean, in order to challenge the declarations made in a Vaughan Index, the FOIA requester must come forth with some evidence that contradicts the statement or implies some bad faith on behalf of the affiant.
You don't have to get to bad faith in this case. We've said in our case law says bald assertions. That's our quote. Bald assertions are not enough. And in that case, which was Billington, the affiant's statement was far more specific than here. It said this information was received with the explicit understanding that it would be held in the strictest confidence. And we call that a bald assertion, inadequate under our case law.
Your Honor, I think coupled between the text of the emails as released and this statement, it establishes that these emails were submitted with a request for confidentiality and that the State Department understood that request was that they were being submitted in confidence. I believe that is sufficient under any standard to invoke the confidentiality provisions of 26I2 or 26I1 to protect these emails from disclosure. Moving on to 2605H, the State Department believes it is clear that from the statutory text that this is an Exemption 3 statute. FACA Section 10B is the provision that Congress has enacted that specifically and expressly incorporates the FOIA disclosure provisions to advisory committees. By implementing the Convention on Cultural Property Implementation Act and creating an exception to that express incorporation,
We agree with you about that. Do we still have to do the deliberative process privilege?
Your Honor, I do believe that there is at least one document, and again, in the committee reports themselves, the redactions have in the margins the provisions.
So we have to address this question.
You have to address.
So let me ask you about that.
Yes, Your Honor.
As I understand the government's position here, and I'm looking at page 43 of your brief, you say that CPAC reports are non-binding pre-decisional recommendations to states' final decision, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So is it the government's position that all CPAC reports are exempt under the deliberative process privilege?
Your Honor, we believe that the findings and recommendations contained in those reports are exempt. We release them in part, Your Honor.
So the government's position is CPAC reports are exempt because they're deliberative and pre-decisional, right? Because it's the state that makes the final decision. Right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So then what's the role of 306H?
2605H, Your Honor?
Yeah. What's the role of that? Because it says, if you read H, sub H, you would think that what Congress had in mind here was that the provisions of FOIA apply, of course, including its exemptions, but that with respect to public availability of documents, that they can be exempted by the Assistant Secretary issuing a declaration, a determination under sub F, right? In other words, under your theory, the Assistant Secretary would never have to issue this determination in order to exempt final reports of CPAC, right?
That, I believe in certain circumstances or certain portions of CPAC, I believe that is correct. They don't need to necessarily invoke that if they're relying on another.
It has no role under your theory of it because they're all deliberative and pre-decisional.
The provision certainly has a role, Your Honor, to protect other information that was discussed in.
Well, but the statute says our obligation is to give effect to statutes and all the words in them, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And it says, you're right, it still might have some effect with respect to open meetings, okay? But it says public availability of documents. And you've told me that the government's view is that the deliberative process privilege protects CPAC reports.
Reports,
and
yes,
if that's the case, then you don't need F for CPAC reports, right?
You don't need F for CPAC reports, but it's the public availability of documents. I don't think it's limited to CPAC reports, Your Honor. I believe that this protects more than just CPAC reports because it protects all documents that reflect the communications or deliberations in closed meetings and other matters that the Assistant Secretary has determined may harm the negotiating objectives of the United States. And in particular, it references Section 10B of FACA, which it starts off by saying subject to Section 552 of Title V U.S. Code, that is the FOIA. So it's incorporating, FACA itself incorporates the FOIA exemptions. If the statutory scheme contemplated only one particular type of matter that may be withheld, it wouldn't incorporate the other FOIA exemptions. Consequently, we believe that the other FOIA exemptions are applicable. As far as Exemption 5 goes, these are clearly pre-decisional and deliberative assessments akin to internal staff recommendations, just like the court confronted in the Washington Research Project case that we cited in a brief. They are deliberative to the agency's final determination on the...
That wasn't a case where you had a separate statute with its own disclosure requirement.
No, Your Honor, but again, I think the separate statute here incorporates the exemptions from disclosure of FOIA, as this court has held in other FACA cases. The arguments that the guilds present as far as Exemption 5, we don't believe are with merit, and I'm happy to discuss those if the court would like.
On the closing of meetings,
yes, Your Honor.
Counsel for the plaintiff said that there's no indication of what was closed and what was not closed. Is that correct?
Your Honor, I believe that the State Department specifically said that the information that was being withheld under 2605H, for example, from the committee reports, says all the material withheld in these documents under 2605H concerns a matter about which closed committee proceedings took place and either consists of information provided to and considered by the committee or conveys the views of the committee and committee members regarding recommendations it is tasked with making about foreign government's requests. That's on Joint Appendix 86 regarding the reports. Also, the fact that...
And in the absence of Londano, Billington, and Campbell, that factual proposition can rest on hearsay.
Yes, Your Honor. And also, Your Honor, the existence, the fact that these meetings were closed wasn't challenged by the guilds in their brief. As I read the brief, they contend that there had to be some additional finding somewhere in some record that upon which to invoke 2605H, and that is not what you need. Because they didn't challenge that these meetings were in fact closed, we didn't put in our brief, but the existence of closed meetings is in the public record. It's in the Federal Register. Every time a meeting is closed, the Cultural Property Advisor Committee, it's in the public register, and certainly they have enough information to try to challenge redactions if they believe these meetings weren't closed. But we didn't, from reading their brief, we didn't believe that they were actually challenging the existence of closed meetings. Unless the panel has any other questions, the State Department asks that the judgment of the District Court be affirmed. Thank you.
Counsel for appellant.
Counsel, I have a question for you. On the Londano question, your opening brief does not cite our opinions, mainly Campbell and Billington, interpreting and applying Londano, so that to the extent that there's daylight between Londano itself and our interpretations, it's not clear whether you can rely on our interpretations.
Well, you're
maybe there is no daylight. I don't know.
The fact is, the appellants believe that the government never went the next step. Your interpretations of Londano were when then the government was trying to, after Londano came down, trying to show confidentiality. In this case, we don't believe that they even tried to show specific confidentiality in the specific cases. And so...
Well, they certainly asserted, with respect to specific items, that it was received in confidence, and provided in confidence, right?
They didn't say...
Now, let's assume, arguendo, that the evidence in support of that doesn't meet Campbell and Billington. To the extent that it's unclear whether it met Londano, that would be you would have at least some sort of problem in insisting on the Campbell and Billington standards.
Well, we have stated that they make conclusory statements.
Well, don't get trapped here. You argued Londano, and I thought your position was that this didn't meet Londano. It never occurred to me until counsel for the government stood up that there was an express commitment to confidentiality. I thought you were applying the Londano standard. You should just stick with it.
Yes, Your Honor. on that, in fact, in what responding to the government, when you're looking the email on Joint Appendix 311 that we're discussing that we do not believe meets the Londano standard, the district court did not cite to that email, and if you read it, the email
summary judgment, that makes no difference, whatever.
The email itself also says, from the government coming to Ms. Park, says, please be discreet about our conversation if you don't mind. The government, again, asking her to be discreet, not her asking for any confidentiality, which under Londano, they would have to, the government has to establish that she is the one understanding confidentiality.
I have no idea whether Cohen is alive or dead, but...
She's deceased.
What?
I believe she is deceased, Your Honor.
I know she is dead, but I'm saying Cohen.
Oh, yes.
So what if both of them are dead? There's no way that the... I mean, I suppose her... Actually, even now, her interest in confidentiality is diminished, but in that case, the government cannot win unless there's a letter in file from the provider of information demanding confidentiality.
Well, even though we are the requesters here, I would say that the government could win because Mr. Cohen doesn't work in a vacuum, and that other people aware of how his office operates in the conversations, maybe the government may be able to provide specific rationale for why she believed that her correspondence with him, the information she provided to him, was confidential.
A third person commenting on the
Not necessarily commenting.
Cohen Park's email exchange.
People would know in that office. It's the government, because Mr. As the government points out, the declarant doesn't have to be Mr. Cohen. They could explain how the confidentiality, how they believe it's confidential. I'm not 100% sure how they're going to do that, and I don't want to give them that, but I think they could do it.
All right. Anything further, counsel, other than building the government's case?
They talked about Exemption 5 and the CPAC reports. We just want to state that Congress, in implementing the CPIA, did come up with under 2605 F and G areas where the Congress wanted the CPAC reports to be provided, number one, to the entire CPAC report provided to Congress, and when there are differences between the CPAC recommendations and the State Department's final actions, the State Department is required under the CPIA to let Congress know that there are differences and what those differences are. And because of that, we don't believe that it's a true deliberative process type situation.
All right. Anything further?
That's all I have,
Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll take the case under advisement.
Thank you.